Hey everyone, on this week's episode I'm joined by Marty Turco, the winningest goaltender in Dallas Stars history and 2006 member of the Canadian Olympic team. Before pro, he attended Michigan University, where he won two national championships and more games than any other goalie in the D1 record books. Turks revolutionized goaltending by creating the eponymously named Turco Grip, forever changing how we handle the puck. Hope y'all down in Texas enjoy this one. In honor of Dime and Vinnie Paul, get your pull.
6 degrees, Mike. What's up? How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing well, man. What's going on in your world today? Give us a little bit of insight to what you've done since you retired from the game and made a home in Dallas.
Oh, wow. Yeah, you said we only had an hour, man. Come on now.
Condense it, man. Let's do it in like, give me like 3 minutes of what you're doing currently, because I know you got a lot of irons in the fire. You're a busy guy.
I like being busy. We got three kids. Came back to Dallas to retire and start life ever after. Currently work for the Dallas Stars. Brad Albert's our president. He's been awesome. So I work with him. We'll run the foundation, which I love. That's one of the best parts of being a professional athlete, is working in the community. So that's amazing. And also, my cousin have a brewery up in Ontario that's relatively new, but kicking butt, called Kingsville. So we're selling a lot of beers and making a lot, building, tap room, construction. That part's never fun, but that's the way it goes. So those are the main things, but mostly working full-time in Dallas with the Dallas Stars organization has been eye-opening, learning the business side of it. I've been really fascinated with it. And so that's the latest, chasing kids around too. You know, we got two girls in high school. Little guy that plays hockey, he'll be 11 soon, my man. So just looking to retire another time. You know what I'm saying?
is your son going to follow in the family footsteps and put the pads on?
No, he's going to. He wants to play goal. He's expressed interest. I told him he's not flexible enough and the legs aren't strong enough. You know how important that is. But he's still 10, turning 11, like I said. But he's interested, kind of wanting to be a better skater. And I mean, I watch you wheel around and some of the best in the world. And the one thing that's the most consistent I find is their skating ability. I just find it vital. And so we're not going to rule him out as a goalie quite yet, but certainly steering him towards scoring goals and making plays. But, you know, we'll go. I'll let him dictate it, but just trying to give him a little skill base, which I think is super important.
I always thought it was just as fun, and that's why I played forward in the summertime, to give me a little bit of a different feel for the game. And I still do it. I play with my dad in the summer, and it's like playing a whole different sport. And I think it's kept me sane all these years that I could go out and play goal, knowing that I was going to get a break in the summertime.
Dude, I love playing forward then. I loved playing forward growing up. I love playing forward now. Scoring goals. And this is a goalie. You're like, okay, I know what it's like to score goals or try to score goals, that perspective. And I think that perspective is vital as a goalie, kind of understanding the other side's, the shooter's mentality. And then even better, dude, knowing what it's like to score a goal, put your hands in the air and everybody's celebrating, the lights red, and win a game or tie something up. And then the best part of it is knowing what it's like to take it away from that little happy person who wants to score a goal.
For sure.
Now that made me happier. Get a little nastiness in it. But, man, what a feeling to make 35 saves a game and get the win. There's really nothing better.
Well, for someone like you that handled the puck so much and were so good at it, what made you decide to be a goaltender when you were a kid? Because obviously you were skilled with it, that you could have done either of them, I think, have been successful. So if you could just give me background on, one, how you became a goaltender, and then also how you eventually ended up going to University of Michigan and playing Division I college hockey instead of going to major junior, especially for being a Canadian guy from Sault Ste. Marie. So if you could just lead us a little bit into that story, that'd be great.
Well, dude, it's... you know, growing up in a little hockey mecca, Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario, awesome upbringing, cold weather, pretty easy to play some hockey on the regular, which we did all summer too with the tennis ball. But I was 9 years old, played travel hockey as a forward when I was 8. They asked at when I was 9, you know, hey, you want to play half the year net? And I went back to house league to do so. I played half the year net and half the year forward. At the beginning of the year, even I got my turn right away. They're like, man, you want to play half the year in goal? And I was like, yeah, you know, I'll do it. And really, really enjoyed it. And I think the kicker was there was a couple, but I was small, but I was pretty good at it. And I remember we played the rep team younger, which, you know, a lot of house league teams do. And I played in goal, and the game was close. It was a low scoring game, but we lost. And I'm like, told my coach, say, next time we play, I want to play forward because I want to make sure we could score some goals against these guys. And I remember playing forward, and we got beat 8-1, and I only scored one goal. I needed to score 9. I figured we had a better chance of winning if I was the goalie. Yeah, that was the secret ticket right there. And so the next year at age 10, I started full-time. Did that for the next 26 years. And we, just after that, too, Mike, we end up getting Greyhound billets. They're our junior A team there to St. Marie. Billeted, stayed at our house. These guys were, you know, the age group in high school. They have beards on. They're men. They're the best hockey players in town. They're just put on a pedestal. And I wanted to be them. Really did, dude. I really wanted to be a Sault Ste. Marie Greyhound. I went to a lot of their games. Every opportunity I could. If we had tickets, I went. It was just an awe. Fortunately for me, and at the time, unfortunately, I was sad. Never got drafted to the O. Never got an invite to even their camp as just a scrub. And just at this time, I was starting to grow and got challenged by my midget coach to actually practice hard and apply myself. Maybe I had enough skill to do something. I was a year and a half, maybe even less, from finishing my hockey career in Sault Ste. Marie as a high schooler. I was looking at going to school in Ontario, and just kept sprouting up and playing better, and was challenged, and that really made a difference for me. Shocker, comes down to just work ethic and actually paying attention and honing your craft. And so anyway, we had really good teams. Junior B and Junior C and Tier 1 hockey wasn't a big thing for a lot of our players in my hometown. We had a few that had left. And our midget team, my second year midget, dude, we went to the Air Canada Cup. It was a big deal for a small town. Hadn't lost many games that season. And went there to the Cup as a top goalie there. Was offered a scholarship for Michigan Tech. Knowing nothing about NCAA hockey. I was just taking it back. So anyway, I was like, I need a break. I went to Gulf Storm junior, their camp, major junior camp, 40 hours the next year. They said I could make the team. I was 18. And then I wish I knew the GM's name at the time, dude. I just want to thank him. He said, after my 48 hours, I gave a Linky to play. And I looked him at the eye. I had no family advisor. My dad there. I was doing this all on my own, but it helped that I had just turned 18 years old. And I said, hey, well, you tell me, what am I doing here in the next 2 years? Do I got to beat out the starting goalie and get an NHL contract? Like that's the whole point of being here. And he could have said whatever else, but he just told me the truth. He's like, yeah, pretty much that's what you're doing here. And so I went to Cambridge, Ontario, and played for the Winterhawks at my junior B. That's where I got recruited, visited St. Lawrence, you know.
Yeah.
You know, visited St. Lawrence, some other schools, visited Michigan. I really wanted to go to Michigan and play there. I didn't know, it was crazy to me that was even an option. And so they were waiting their sweet time. They were trying to pick the right one to replace Steve Shields. Had to pass up some of those up schools. They're like, if you don't tell us now, we got to move on. And I said, well, I'll regret it if I don't wait. So I took a big leap of faith. And got a call, made 50 saves one Saturday night in Listowel, Ontario, somewhere in the middle of South Western Ontario. Red was at the game, Red Berenson. He called on Monday and offered me the scholarship. A couple months later, got drafted to the Stars, too, right out of Junior B, while I was sleeping, no less. And so, and there's a, you know, there's a funny story. After my last game in Junior, I was getting ready to go home, and Tim Bernard, head scout at the time, also an old goalie for the Dallas Stars anyway, came to Galt Arena in Cambridge, and I went out to the bowels. It's the oldest arena in Ontario. Really neat spot. And Tim, I was with my dad because we drive home the next day with my teammate and his dad from the shoot. And Tim was like, hey, I watch you play. Really enjoy you. I'm like, it's crazy. I'm talking to NHL scout. Just never even fathomed it. But he's like, I don't know anything about you. Do you have time when you're down here in the locker room? Just meet me at a local spot and chat. And just casually. And I was like, well, you know, Mr. Bernhard, it's my last game going to Michigan next year. We had a fabulous season. We didn't win it all, but it was a great year for this team. And I'll probably never really see most of these guys or almost all of them again in my life. And there's a party tonight. So if you don't mind, I might go straight to the party and join my last night in Cambridge. And he looked at me and kind of smirk on his face. He's like, all right, I guess I understand. Anyway, thanks for your time. And that was it. But my dad was burning holes in me, and he's like, dude, what are you doing? But
I'm going to party with my teammates, kids, man. What do you think I'm doing?
So I don't know if that, I would have assumed that would hurt you, but it might have helped. And who knows? But Tim and I laughed about it years later, and I got the call sleeping on my waterbed back in the day from Tim and Craig Button and Les Jackson. Those good dudes. So that was it for me, man, in a nutshell.
Can you believe when you went to Michigan, though, that later you're going to be all-time winningest NCAA goalie? Did you know that you were going to play a lot of games right from the start freshman year?
I didn't know. Red said he likes to play one guy, but, I mean, Steve Shields, who was my predecessor, had the NCAA record. They went to Final Fours. They had won a national championship. Steve was 6'4". I know Red was looking for a big goalie. I was 150-some pounds when I got to campus. I could barely play two nights in a row. So there was a lot of learning to do physically and mentally for me. I got it in bunches. I got it quick. But the work ethic and the strength came over time. I was very fortunate to have, you know, Red, you know, believe in me, but also want to groom me. So I didn't start the first game. The third stringer from the year before was now a senior and the other goalie, and he was expected to get a chance to play. Then I started the second game, and even though we didn't win, Red started me the third game, and I think I played 10 in a row and then pretty much played most of them the rest of the year. So I didn't know, but, you know, looking back, just, you know, what an unbelievable opportunity to play on those great teams, to evolve into a leader, to get a chance to play every night, to stay healthy, play all 4 years, and, you know, get a crack at four Final Fours, man.
And then win two NCAA titles. I mean, what's that like? What's the celebration like when you do that not once, but the second time after you've already tasted it?
Well, they're both different. And, you know, I got to say, Mike, with complete honesty, that, you know, those two semifinal losses they hurt just as much as the other ones feel good. The first one, the school I've won in 34 years. I was a sophomore. Brendan Morrison scored an overtime goal to send our team program, athletic department, campus, and alumni in a frenzy. Hockey was on fire. Like I said, we had great teams and great players. So to win the first one was just so jubilant and shocking. And, you know, Red had a monkey off his back. It was a combination of all everybody in the program, you know, all the old players and our Deakers, you know, our booster club, like just the can't believe it moment was just so shocking. And then the 97 class, we were 98, of Morrison, Bottrill, John Madden, Blake Sloan, Harold Shaw, Chris Freskin, Peter Burke, Mike Legg. I don't think I'm missing them. There's nine of them. Warren Looning, there's the ninth. Warren Looning, who's an animal too. Those guys left after we had three losses going to the NCAA tournament, losing in the finals in our junior year. So we had 11 freshmen come in the next year. So to win that one as a senior in your last game ever, grooming freshmen, you finish year with only 10 left the program, was just such a gratifying feeling as a senior class, as a program, to know that in a rebuilding year, you do things the right way and sacrifice a lot, you know, of your time to do something for the greater good, being the team, is so much worth it. So the two are equally amazing. You know, when you're just different position parts of your career, and it's only a 4-year deal, that they mean so many different things to us. But that last game got us to be the winningest class in Michigan hockey history, to triumph from the year before, the great heralded 97 class. So we like to rub that in their face more than we do the second national championship. So there's only two classes that are double national champions. Anyway, from our era. So it was unbelievable, dude. What a time we had there. It wouldn't have changed if we won zero national championships, by going back and celebrating and reminiscing with the faculty and the staff and the athletic department, and of course, the guys. It's a great feeling.
So I got to say thank you to you, because I was lucky enough, when I think I was 13 or 14, to go to Joe Louis Arena, see Michigan State play against one another. And watching you and Chad Albin sauce the puck down the ice back and forth, the way you guys were handling the puck changed my life, because immediately I knew I had to be able to do that. And I'd never seen it. Like, I'd seen Hextall shoot the puck off the glass in the out. I'd seen him score a goal. But you guys took it to a whole different level. And I want to know how puck handling evolved in your game, because to me, you really set the benchmark and the high watermark in hockey. And I know everybody talks about Marty, the other Marty, Brodeur, causing the trapezoid to happen. But to me, it was you, Brodeur, DiPietro, the reason why it came in. So how did puck handling become such a part of your game, and how did you perfect it?
Well, the good news is you never perfect it, especially for the kids out there. We all know that. I had things I worked on a daily basis. I'm glad you remember that. My probably memory perspective was that, you know, fast forward 10 years after college hockey at the Joe, saucing around with Chad Albin, that I thought I was a million times better at playing the puck. I was pretty good in college, especially for college kids. My biggest disappointment was lack of strength. I was getting stronger. You know, the sticks and the gloves weren't just as good as they were 10 years later, or even a few. And it wasn't until I really turned my hand over and developed the grip, with the handover process, that really elevated my ability to handle the puck. And so, you know, Chad was good at it. We found it really efficient in college to get out there and move the puck. It was a work in progress. It was learning. You know, coaches, we didn't practice it like we did once we got to the NHL. When I turned pro and got to the Dallas Stars training camp in the season, and I was very lucky to have Ed Belcour in front of me, where he moved the puck in a really efficient way, moved it up the ice pretty good. But he moved the puck side to side with his defenseman, with a defenseman we're used to going to the corners and outnumbering them, you know, the right. Two forecheckers.
Yeah, he had a proper system that allowed the team to break out effectively out of the zone, right?
Yeah, so I went from college and then right to the pros, where guys weren't coming to me and we didn't have to argue or go over that separation at the onset. So that was a big advantage. But the ultimate one that I said was the grip, you know. And once I turned my hand over, I remember the first time I did it, and you know, these drills that you do, and you get on your backhand side, you know, for you it's on the opposite deal, but they're rimming the puck around. The coach was, and the drill was just to stop it and then slide it into the corner. And I remember I kept losing it because I had no power on your toe on my backhand side. So I remember chasing the puck, you know, scurry up in front of me. And finally, I literally just turned my hand over, jammed it into the boards as hard as I could, made sure it stopped. And even the first time I did it, I turned it back around, played it forehand or the conventional way. And then the next time we introduced forecheckers, to the drill, and I didn't have time to turn my hand back around. So I just played the puck on my forehand side, but with my hand, and I was like, man, that felt really good. And then all of a sudden I realized I had a backhand that I could get up on the glass consistently. And I just started playing with it. And all of a sudden, you know, I went from a dispersion rate of, call it 20 degrees, maybe 15 on the traditional way. Now I could, with an athletic posture, I can, my dispersion rate went to 85 degrees. Now I can put pucks underneath me without telegraphing it, without changing my whole body. I can open my face and give a little flick. I can do it off the toe, off the heel. And more importantly, now that it opened up, I had confidence to go to my backhand side, even with a little saucer, getting it hard on the glass around, if I needed to beat a forechecker. And that was a game changer right there, was that I couldn't telegraph it. I had an athletic posture, and I had access to both sides. And even though I couldn't get it as high as I wanted to, if I was going down the ice or over top of somebody, than a traditional play because of the open chain style system, the backhand, or my accuracy and my flat passing and the ability to soft it flat became exponentially better. And that to me was just a massive game changer. And you know, you've seen it, and now you see every goalie do it. I don't think I've seen any, I don't know if there's anybody other than Anton Nibodin here in Dallas. I don't know who else doesn't turn their hand over. And I look at him, I just shake my head. He's pretty good at it, but I'm like, just imagine how good you'd be, dude, if you turn that hand over. So I take a lot of paternal pride when I see all these young goaltenders professionally or just playing at local rinks, playing the way that I did.
I mean, you literally discovered something. You have something in goaltending named after you. And we're talking about the Turco grip. And for people who aren't familiar with it, it's when you turn your hand over on the goalie stick, which is what everybody does now. It looks normal. I never did that until later. And even if I was still trying to get height on the puck, I still had to go traditional because I couldn't get it nearly as high or as hard with the Turco grip. Now, backhand and flat passes and everything, I could rip it no problem like that. So I actually found myself still using a little bit of both. And I think Marty Brodeur was the last guy besides Hudobin who still went traditional a little bit. But there's not many of us left. You know, you get done with Michigan. Did you know that you were going to be going straight to the IHL when you were done with it? Because you spent two full seasons in the zoo, Kalamazoo. And I'm wondering what the IHL was like back then, because it was a regional league that was a little bit different than the American League where guys end up now. So how did that process go coming out of college to end up in pro?
Yeah, I knew, man. We had we had two changeovers. So once you get drafted, you're paying attention to your team and all that. And I was like, man, this team's stacked. So I get to training camp. Actually, you'll laugh at this one. Before, you know, rookie camp now. So I went to rookie camp. There's no rules in the CBA about it. But I was unsigned. So before my first training camp, I got to Dallas. The first time I ever was more south than Cincinnati, Ohio. I flew into Dallas in July. It was hot as heck. And I thought I was going to die when I walked off the plane with jeans on. And my agent's like, you can't go to Dallas, dude. You're not signed. So we were having a little issue, just me getting signed out of college. And he's like, dude, you cannot go. You cannot go. Anyway, I'm like, I'm going, you know, I'm all about the boys. I don't want to start off on the wrong foot. He goes, well, you just can't put the pads and you can go hang out. I'm like, sweet. So anyway, the first time I ever played, you know, I was in a rookie camp. I actually played forward.
No. So are you serious? In Dallas?
I swear to God, in Dallas. I was standing there at the red line waiting for the drill, you know, doing drills, you know, and I remember Morrow skating up behind me and he's like, he was 18 years old and 19. He's still playing in Portland. He went back that year to go win a Memorial Cup. And by then, you know, the only prospects you ever seen was once a year in the hockey news, right? There's no internet. Nobody knew who's going on other than word of mouth. And he's a Western kid. I was from Ontario. I went to school. He's a major junior. Anyway, he's standing behind me and he goes, hey, dude, I would have swore Turco, you're a goalie. And I was like, man, maybe I'm pretty good at playing forward. I said, yeah, guy, I am a goalie. So anyway, I went to training camp that year. Yeah, I went to training camp, and I look around. There's Eddie Belfour. This is training camp 1998. Roman Turek, maybe the best goalie I've ever seen in practice. This guy, nobody could score on him. I mean, he didn't move. I was so jealous. Manny Fernandez was there. I was like, if I was to build a goalie today, it would be Manny Fernandez. Still today, the way he, you know, he was big, he was 6'2", he was strong, he had a great posture about him. The way he moved and caught the puck, I was like, man, that's like, I get it. And then my Mike Bales was there too, and became my partner.
It's a stacked organization, man.
Yeah, and then even then, I was, then Daryl Ray was practicing with us on the regular as well. Razor. So he was the practice goalie. A lot of the times when Eddie wasn't there. So I was like sixth on the depth chart when I got there. So I was just happy to find a spot in Kalamazoo. Mike Bales and I, for the first half of the season, split every game until Christmas or Christmas break, and we figured it out. So I had a clue. I was kind of hoping for a chance for the second year, but they had penciled Manny in. Had to go in the office with Bob Ganey and tell him my feelings, which was probably the most daunting thing I've had to do in my life, but I thought it was proper share my feelings. The 2 years in the Kalamazoo, man, we were terrible. The league was awesome though. Just think, man, we had teams in Orlando, Long Beach, Vegas had a team back then, Kansas City, the Chicago Wolves had a team, Cincinnati had a team, the Vipers, Cleveland. It was just a great league. Travel was awesome. Milwaukee was a big city, but that was on the bus circuit. We also had Grand Rapids, a beautiful town. Fort Wayne and Indianapolis. Those rinks weren't so amazing. Anyway, there's a few others, but it was a great league. We shut the league down. I was involved in the highest penalty minute game against Fort Wayne, 401 penalty minutes, I think it was.
Oh,
it was,
how many did you have?
Oh, my. I got one with Pokey Redick, dude.
Because you had a lot really of games in your career. Pokey. Like, you had a lot of penalty minutes and assists. Like, I can't believe you didn't have a Gordie Howe at some point.
Well, you know, at the end of the day, I didn't have any goals either. So I always said they didn't pay me to fight or score goals. They just paid me to take some pims, protect my crease, and move the puck out of the zone. So that Razor put that stat recently of how many pims I did have. I was like, oh, that's a lot.
Did you get a chance to black ace for Dallas during the cup runs in 99, 2000?
Oh, yeah, dude. It was unbelievable. So the first year, I didn't get there until kind of the end of the first round. But what an experience for me. I just went from Air Canada Cup midget year, Sutherland Cup championship in finals anyway, in junior. Four straight Final Fours in college. And then my first year pro, we got a crappy team in the minors. And we go to the Stanley Cup Finals. And we win, you know, they win the cup in Buffalo. I'm there for a bunch of days partying. It was such a blast. And I just loved it. The next year back in the minors, did the cup run again. Came really close. Watched Berdur and Eddie in that finals. Hasek and Eddie. The year before, he beat Patrick Waugh twice in the Western Conference Finals, which are unbelievable series, and two great teams and organizations. So I got a really great taste of some meaningful hockey. I also got to be around the staff, the media, wives and families, people in Dallas before I ever got to play one game, man. So the time I ever got there, not only was I 25 years old before I played my first game, but I was around the organization for probably a combined 8 months. I got called up twice during the IHL days, never played a game. And then was that black ace. So, man, I was very, very fortunate to be around the Stars organization, learn a lot before I ever got my chance to back up Betty. So that was really beneficial for me.
After they won the cup, did you get a chance to meet Dime and Vinny from Pantera? Because I heard those guys hosted some of the greatest cup parties, like, in the history of sports.
I was there, man. I was there when the cup got dented. It was the bomb in the pool. I remember someone asked me, they're like, hey, kid, go get the cup. And I was like, are you serious? like, I don't know, man. I know how heavy that thing is now, and it's in the bottom of the pool. I ain't going to get there. Good luck. See you later. Yeah, I went to his birthday party. It sucks. You know, we missed both of them.
Yeah.
Vinny was an unbelievable fan.
It was a big thrill for me to hear the Dallas fight song coming out because Pantera recorded it, and I was being a big Pantera fan. Every time I heard it, it just kind of sent chills down my spine. And you're right, we really miss Dime and Vinny. I know they were tight with you guys.
Yeah, you know, Dime wasn't around hockey as much, but Vinny was. He spent a lot of time with Eddie and Craig Ludwig and the guys. I hung out with him every time I saw him, and I went to his birthday party. It was probably 4 months before he had passed. And so, it just sucks. So we've been to the house in Arlington, been in the room where they recorded the Dallas Stars song. They played it. I think I'm still half deaf because of it. But he, I know you love Metallica or rock music and metal stuff. And those guys are infamous in that.
Oh yeah,
in that circle.
So when you came out of the IHL, was it a big vote of confidence to just straight up make the team in 2000? You know, you see some guys who kind of waffle between the two, but you already said how you'd been able to understudy in the playoffs. So did you feel comfortable right away when you got to Dallas?
I felt pretty comfortable, and part of my game was having confidence and believing in myself. But I also saw these other guys that I had to, outperform or make them less valuable than they were in the organization. But I was just like, I was as confident and cocky as a person or player that I was and the people perceived me to be. I always had a little anxiety of just like belonging, and that part of growing up a small guy and not very good and blooming late and just playing the way I played.
I know that feeling 100%. Like, especially for me, always being like a number three guy, you're kind of like watching your toes as you walk around the locker room. And the older I got, I was like, you know what, man, enough of this. Like, I just need to be myself. Who cares if I come in hot? You know what I mean? So I know exactly what you mean by that.
Well, I was always myself. I think that's part of my demeanor that came easy naturally. So I didn't walk around on eggshells, but I was always mindful, like, man, I got to bust my butt here. Work ethic, gym, Michigan prepared me really, really well. And to go be myself, but that underlying work ethic, she stands on top of your game. But I always felt like, man, even though I'm here, I gotta feel like I gotta make sure I belong. And then you go to third string and you're like, man, all right, now it's a chance. And I don't want to totally undermine my career, but I was very lucky to have the expansion era right around that time. And so what most people don't know, really I don't like to talk about it because it doesn't paint a great picture, but after we won the cup, 2 days later, we traded Roman Turk to the St. Louis Blues because we weren't going to protect him on that year's expansion draft. The next year, Manny Fernandez backs up Eddie. He's the backup for the 2000 cup run, and he gets taken to Minnesota expansion draft that year. So when the dust settles, if we looked around, they're like, who else we got? And I'm the only guy left. And they're like, all right, Turco, you're gonna back up Eddie next year. And I'm like, well, yeah, no crap, you don't have anybody. So that summer of 2000, I was getting married, and there's a really odd rule in the CBA that says after 3 years pro, if you're 25 years old and haven't played 30 games in the NHL, you become an automatic, unrestricted free agent. And I turned pro. This is the only time in my life. My late birthday was an advantage. I'm an August 13th kid. And so I turned pro, my first, so 98 is my first year. So at the end of my second year, that summer, I was still 24 years old. And we're on a July 1 fiscal year. And so I get married. And in that line, I had a 2-year deal because I was 22 years old out of college. So the 2-year deal, because I was older, instead of a 3-year deal for entry level. So my deal was up and they told us, hey, just sign your qualifying offer and we'll figure it out. And my agent's like, comes to my wedding reception. We're in the line getting ready to do, the traditional Italian shots. And, he hands me my qualifying offer. and I take it back. They told me not to sign my qualifying offer at the time. So I wasn't signing my qualifying offer. He said, don't sign the qualifying offer. We'll figure it out. But if I didn't sign it, then they had, there's nothing for me to go back on. They could do whatever they want. They could hold out, or I'd have to hold out unless I signed the deal that they had. So he signed in the receiving line at my wedding, my qualifying offer. And we laugh about it. We still laugh about it to this day. And so now I have a deal, which is a two-way deal. You get 5-10% increase, whatever it was. And now we had say, hey, listen, we'll go play the year on a one-year deal. And if we have to, otherwise we'll negotiate. And so anyway, going into that season, they would have to play me 30 games minimum because I never played a game. And at the end of that year, I was 25, but I was still 25 by July 1 because my birthday wasn't until August. So at the start of that season, and this is what you might throw up on, I never played a game yet. I end up signing a 3-year deal all one way, club option on the third year before I ever played a game in the NHL. And I even bought a house before I got my first check because I knew it because I signed a 1-year. It was like 2 days before camp or before season started. They're so mad at me, but they're like, hey, you know what? You could do what Lou Lamoriello did and put me in 30 games. He did it to Mike Dunham where, there was still a bad rule in there that says you only have to take one shift, and there was no clause for goalies saying, hey, you have to play 20 minutes or something. So Lou did that to Mike Dunham, took Brodeur out for a power play, put Dunham in for a shift, took him back out, and then he got just 30 games, and he told him to go fly a kite at the end of the year. And Bob Gainey didn't want to do that, and so we negotiated a 3-year deal, all one-way money, and which set me up for the rest is history kind of moment. So anyway, my first year starting, dude, they picked up the option. They said, Eddie's not going to come back. You're going to take over. And I had 1 year left. You know, I think it was $850K. It was rolling in it. And so I thought. And then anyway, I had my banner year of that 1.72, and second highest save percentage ever. And that gives my platform year right there, man.
Pretty good timing to have that season. 1.72 goals against, 9.32 save percentage. Huge season. I want to just roll it back for a second, though, because I want to ask what it was like to play with Eddie the Eagle, you know, as his kind of as his understudy, his backup goalie partner. How was it playing alongside him?
Oh, I got great memories, man. This is, you know, some of them that Eddie was Eddie, and he was great to me during the cup runs. Wasn't as great to me when I was his partner. Even moved my stall away from his my second year with him. I don't think I was that annoying, but maybe I was. And anyway, he was great, man. He was such a warrior. He's the best in the world at one point there. I got to witness it. But the guy was a gamer, man. The way goalies should be treated is like, hey, this guy's going to show up. He's going to win us hockey games and we need him. He could do whatever he wants. Now it's like, you know, load management. It's like, oh my God, he didn't play great last night. He should have that one. Don't put him in. And you're like, the loyalty is gone. So, and we had a lot of loyalty towards Eddie. And all I ever asked, especially in my second year playing with him, he wasn't playing well at all. And, but they were playing him in the net. Hitchcock got fired. Bob Gainey fired himself. That's when Doug Armstrong took over. Rick Wilson was our interim coach, and Rick and him knew each other from North Dakota, and they're playing each other, or he's playing Eddie all the time. And I was like, well, honestly, that doesn't people like, oh, don't you think you should be playing? I was like, listen, I hope to play as well as Eddie Belfour has in his career, and I hope that I can get as much respect that Eddie is getting because he deserves it. And the guys believed in him, and it was a treat to watch him. And so I get to see him now. I'm really proud of him, what he's doing with his whiskey business, Belfour Spirits. But it was good. It was an eye-opening experience, and, you know, not all roses. But, man, the guy was such a warrior. So really, really awesome to get a chance to watch him on a daily basis.
Those couple of years leading into the lockout were huge. We already talked about your record-setting year. Even the next one is really good, and you had some playoff success there. Do you feel like that's what set you up for making the Olympics in 2006? And also, really, how much fun were you having in these All-Star games that you got to do? I remember when they mic'd you up for it and you were talking during the whole game. It just seemed like you were, from the outside, that you were having a lot of fun playing the game.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair to say. That's my personality is to, even now today, man, I put the mask on, which is rare. And I'm glad I don't have to because it hurts. But when I put the mask on, I go right back into that. It's like, you know, going to the phone booth and putting the cape on. You revert back to talking like that, thinking like that, and yelling. And so I was really lucky, Mike, honestly, for not playing a game until I was 25 years old. I had great timing, you know, contracts, team, good team. Doug Armstrong, you know, paid me almost every dollar I've ever made. And Doug also was getting in there with Team Canada. And as much as I'd like to think it was, you know, my ability for the World Cups and Olympics that I went to, you know, Doug had a lot to do with that. And very appreciative of him. I also, by that point, knew I deserved to be there, along with a bunch of other goalies. But I do think, you know, between Doug, how I revered my teammates, being a starter or being a backup or being a third goalie, being a good teammate is something that's very important to me, down to the core. It's how I was taught and it's how I believe and think. So I think that lended a lot to the ability to get on those teams. I had great experiences with Roberto and Verdure in the 2005 World Championships and the 2006 Olympics. Some really great years. Love representing your country. Probably no greater feeling. As a Canadian kid in small towns, what I dreamed of. I didn't do Maple Leafs or Canadians or Bruins or Blackhawks. Drawings when I was a kid was always Team Canada, man. Always Team Canada. And so playing in an All-Star game, my first one in 2003, dude, you laugh at this, but I got my picture, you know, and in the photo, it's beside Patrick Roy. You know, like, this is, geez, at the end of his career, I'm just beginning mine, and he couldn't have been nicer to me. He gave me some really great advice. But he also wanted a stick of mine, which I thought was highly fascinating. And I just got to the rink. I was there maybe 20 minutes and end up in the locker room. I'm packing my stuff. And he's like, you know, Marty, do you mind my son here? You know, I introduced this kid. And he's like, he wants a stick. And I was like, well, hell yeah. Of course I give you a stick, dude. And I said, you know, in fact, I know which one I want to give you. I got it picked out in my head. Let me go get it right now. I got to go to the change room. So I got to walk through stick room or change room and that all the way to the back where the sticks were. The time I get back there, I was walking through the change room, dude. I look over and I see a stick in a stall, and it's Patrick's stall, but it's my stick. He picked out the stick before he even asked me. I was like, what? And I just laughed. I'm like, dude, you could, in my head, you know, Patrick, you could take all my sticks. But you know what I think? And then the more I thought about it years later, I was like, you know what that guy wanted? He wanted to see my curve. He's like, must be the guy's stick. There's no way he's that good at moving the puck. I got to see what his secret weapon is. But anyway, it was a cool feather in my cap for me. It was a great experience. And All-Star games were cool. I got to do one in Dallas, you know, for the hometown team that year that I got mic'd up. So, man, just very, you know, in a short little run of a career, it was had some great highlights and some awesome memories.
You know, I had a previous guest on here that was Ron Tugnutt, your goalie partner for a couple of years, and he wanted to make sure I asked you about your pregame routine of getting dressed in 6-7 minutes flat. You'd shower, and Tugger'd be sitting there in his gear looking around, and all of a sudden you'd come tearing back in the locker room. How did that even start for you?
Well, I mean, I like to be busy. You know, for me, sitting in my locker, banging my head off the wall like the old guys just wasn't my thing, you know, and I watched the guys and the seriousness, and, you know, I just never succumbed to, hey, can't talk to me on game days kind of mentality. So I was of the new age in terms of that. And so I remember Tugger coming there. And so after we said, Eddie won't come back, and Army's like, yeah, I gotta get you a wet veteran, and got us Tugger. And Tugger was a fun man. It was so much fun. We had a blast. And I remember him, watching him the first, you know, month or so, and And, you know, you don't pay attention. Anybody's watching you. And so he comes to me one day, we're having a beer, and he's like, dude, I can't believe you're out there playing soccer, sweating, roughing it up, horsing around, and then you run in here, get dressed, and go on the ice. I'm like, Tugger, like, yeah, I'm into it. It's my ritual, it's my routine, but I just like to get warm. I got a ton of energy, and I just want to sit there and think about thinking all day. This whole game is about not thinking. My preparation is already done, dude. I've already went through it all and visualized it all, and now it's time just to go out there and play. And I don't want to sit there and think about it. He's like, man, I'm sitting over here rocking my stall. I'm like, God, this is for the birds watching you. I'd rather be like that. I'm like, dude, it's just the way you grew up, you know? It's just the way I always was. And so we laugh, man. Oh, yeah, I got six staples in my head one time in Detroit before a game. I bounced the ball with somebody and overshot my landing and hit the stupid spike of Joe Louis. And not sad to see that building coming down as we talk right now. But just split my head open. I got staples in my head. No numbing, no lidocaine or anything. I'm just like, do it, man. I got to go play. And I was like 10 minutes before I had to go get dressed too. But Tugger and I had a blast, man. We had we used to go, this is how good things used to be. We used to do 6 days in Colorado. And one of the years, we had all five goalies in a condo in Breckenridge. And I helped orchestrate it. I'm like, I put the goalies together for a year, especially with Tugger. He's a blast. And we had Mike Smith, who's still playing, my boy. Dan Alice, who's a great goalie, too. And we had Corey Hirsch, who was fabulous, man. The greatest Canadian goalie pads of all time. And how cool, dude. So we had a blast. We had tons of memories. And all I can remember is that Tugger liked to have some fun, but Tugger couldn't hit the booze too much. Because I remember one morning, I thought we were fine, but apparently he wasn't. And he threw up right on the ice, right during the drills in practice in the morning in Colorado. I'm like, come on, Tugger. You're gonna get us all busted here, staying out late one night.
Here you are, the young guy coming in, and you're the bad influence on the old guy, getting him loose.
I didn't say I took him out. All I'm saying is that we went out together with the whole group, nonetheless. But Tugger was awesome, man. He was so good, and we did an annual goalie dinner only night before a game. That was a riot. Got a little nervous one year. We were in Phoenix. Because he had to start the next night. And we didn't know he was going to start. We made the plans without starting. And then he was really fond. And I had an idea, and he helped me with it, to do a goalie D dinner, kind of off the premise of Dan Marino's ice toner gloves, you know, take care of the hands and take care of you. And so one of the coolest things I did looking back was have a goalie D dinner every year and let the players kind of plan it. Like, we pick the dates. It's in San Jose, we'll go to San Francisco, or Phoenix, we'll go to Scottsdale, you know, and I'll buy the dinner and the transportation and entertainment, you know, we'll go out wherever and I'll buy the drinks. And so it was great. It always pissed the forwards off, which made me even happier inside than anything. But it was a great, man. I had great memories of the old Tugginator.
Let's talk gear just for a little bit here, because you wore a Warwick mask your entire career, just like I did. So one, when did you get in touch with Warwick? I know it was probably while you were at college. And then two, let's talk about the gargoyle design on your mask and its evolution.
Yeah, Warwick, those guys in Michigan, so they turned me on. Greg Malachy, my partner, was a Detroit kid. He's still a goalie nutcase. He still plays with the Red Wings alumni. He's their go-to guy. And Shieldsy wore Warwick. So that transition to the work was easy, making my first one. And they were good masks, man. Gary made a really great mask. I took a lot of crap off the head. Always felt pretty safe. That was a great mask, and, you know. So the gargoyles, a guy named Ray Bishop was out of Detroit, and I sat down with him. I never had to design a mask till I turned pro, just because we had the winged helmets in Michigan, and, you know, Ray came up with the gargoyles idea. I said, hey, I want a net protector, you know, and I want a brick wall on there. And he's like, well, gargoyles are the safe keepers. And I was like, ah, it sounds great, even though it wasn't really my thing, like Dungeons and Dragons, I guess. Can equate to that, but no one else had it. It was unique. I thought the style was cool, and then I ended up switching to Dave Art, David Gunderson, who now has the majority of the league, and that Johan Hedberg introduced me to him. You know, Lundqvist wasn't in the league yet, and so I was the first North American kid to get Dave Arndt to do my stuff. Man, he's the best. He has so much business, so I still do some work with him. He's such a good dude. So the mask is the best part of being a goalie. You know that.
That's right. I've got all mine. I think, too, when I look at your stuff, that you always wore CCM or Heat and get, I mean, I think your whole career. And I look at it and you had mismatched gear in college. It was super cool. The yellow and the blue, one pad was one color. The other was the other. And even in pro, like you always had a dark setup. And I even heard that CCM or Reebok used to have a really hard time getting your spec style in because you wanted a super flexible kind of custom pad compared to what they were making. Is there any truth to that?
We did have some issues over the years. I don't have a great barfly, and I still my hip rotation is terrible. So I needed the pads to bend, and so they could curl up and touch, so they could cover the fly ball. Otherwise, you know, knee things weren't making saves back in the days. You had to get your pads to touch, and so that's why I wanted them flexible. I didn't mind them hard at the top, but I wore Heat and all through college. I wore in juniors, my first time I had a brand new set of pads in a long time, and I got to make it. And, you know, for me, we used to go over to Harrow, Ontario, and Kingsville, and my beer company's in Kingsville, called Kingsville Brewing Company. So it's just a meaningful place for me. I got to design my gear with, Mr. Heaton, God rest his soul, and all that fun stuff. And my first year pro, we were really Vaughn in Dallas. And I wore Vaughn pads. My two years back in the Betty, I wore CCM gloves. I'm like, not wearing Vaughn stuff, Vaughn gloves. I couldn't. And then I actually switched, totally switched. My poor trainer had to, you know, really make significant changes to my pads once I got them back from Vaughn on the thigh ride. You know, they're too loose or too stuffy or this and that, too thick or too thin. And so Vaughn, or he made me a pair of pads that pretty much I went with them forever. When they got built by Reebok and I switched to Reebok, they made a great pad. And then, you know, eventually just stuck with the Reebok and the Fave brands once I finally got to be back and had to argue with him to make me a break. And I don't know what he was yelling at me in French that day, but I don't think it was very nice. but we got down to it, brass tacks, and got to design my pad the way I wanted to. I just couldn't pull out like the other guys and blockers. So it was fun, man. I never had equipment deal. I was talking about it this morning with Steve Sumner, our equipment guy. And I was like, man, you get paid so much more to stop pucks well than you do to get paid wearing equipment. And so it was always mixed matching and like whatever works. I wasn't quite eclectic like Timmy Thomas or something. But
right.
You know what you like. And the gloves are really important to me. Playing the puck and feel too. My upper body piece had a Vaughn one probably for, I'd say, 10 of the 11 years in a row there. Real thin one. I wanted to feel it, but also could cross my arms and play the puck the way I did and be pretty agile. I might have given a few goals, but I think I decreased that many more chances to offset that issue.
Yeah, you had 20-something assists in your career. You also chipped in that way. I'm sure it helped. At what point did you know in your career that Dallas was probably going to end up being your home?
You know, that's a good question, but I want to say it pretty early. I married my high school sweetheart. She went to school in Thunder Bay, Ontario, while I was in Ann Arbor. We were together, you know, the whole time. We remember after we bought a place in Sault Ste. Marie, which is about 2001, for the summer, we would do Texas winters, and we'd have Northern Ontario summers. And I just think, somewhere through the winter in the middle of summer, we just looked at each other and like, man, this is perfect. You know, like golfing year round, sunshine in the Texas falls and winters and springs. And then the summer up north, it was great. And we always jumped into the community as well, Mike. And I think that was a big component. A lot of my teammates did not do that. It's just, way it was in my DNA, but it was also the way I was groomed as a Michigan athlete and a Michigan man to give back and be a part of the community that's within you live and work. And so we really grew accustomed to it and loved it. And you know, playing there 10 years and being around for 12 before I left to Chicago, that, you know, you get like street cred and you just, you know, and that helps for life ever after. And plus, it's got everything that we ever want. So the plan is to call this home base and put down some roots for our family as the first generation people in Texas. And so it's pretty early, but it was just that first love of the weather and the changes that we had opportunity to do, and then get involved in the community and understanding the economic upside and the hockey team here and all the sports and entertainment and all the fun stuff. My wife plays tennis. Our girls are in high school. This is home. It's been home for a long time.
I already got to thank you once for influencing me so much as a goalie. But I want to thank you just for coming on and telling your story.
Well, I appreciate you, man. And best of luck. Big fan of yours, man. I'm so glad we got together recently. You got in the Stars organization. You had some great runs, and I know you got lots more to do in life. And so I'll be a fan watching him if you need me. I'm here.
Thanks for listening to 6 Degrees with Mike McKenna. Please make sure that you like, comment, leave a rating, subscribe, whether it's iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, anywhere that you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.